Yeah, keeping in shape, doing some weightlifting, physical conditioning. After what you went through, yeah, no doubt. Well, not just that. Just wanted to do it. For myself, I guess. Then Cal heard another voice. Mr. Jordan, you've been avoiding me. Cal turned and saw the bearded face of Alvin Reardon, the proprietor. He had a strained smile. I told you I wanted to chat while you were here. Karen gave Cal's hand a quick squeeze.
You've got business. I'll let you go. Congratulations on the show.
When Karen had stepped away, Reardon got right down to details. Your work is getting a very positive response.
Good, thanks.
Now it's time to expand, I think. Get you loosened up as an artist. Get more edgy. Find your real artistic center. Your still life work is impressive in technique, but there's more to art than technique.
What are you getting at?
You like to paint traditional stuff. Bowls of grapes with curtains blowing in the background, a worn Bible on the table. That's fine. A certain kind of passive energy there. But you need to break out. That's why I brought you here.
I thought I was here because you liked my paintings.
You're here because of your potential. I would like to bring you along. I want you to bust out of the box you're in.
I didn't know I was in one.
You are, whether you realize it or not. Your mindset is too, well, static, conventional.
What's wrong with that?
It's boring. Look, I know you got this Christian thing going. Okay. What you do with your time on Sunday mornings is your business. But if you are going to be a successful artist, you need to explore the reality beyond your personal beliefs.
Like?
Take Salvador Dali. His crucifixion piece, for example. Jesus floating on a cubic cross, hovering over a chessboard. You could use religious, iconic symbols if you want, that's up to you, but break out of your stuffy, churchy traditionalism.
You know, Mr. Reardon, I just changed my major.
What are you talking about?
I'm leaving the art department at Liberty University.
You mean you're going to an art academy? That's great news.
No, I mean I've decided not to major in art.
That's ridiculous.
No, I don't think so. There's nothing wrong with art. I'll always enjoy it. But I feel like I'm supposed to be doing something else with my time.
Reardon had the look of a racing fan who had just bet on the wrong horse. He stretched out his arm and swept his hand out to take in the whole of his gallery. What could be more important than this to an artist? Cal shrugged.
That's what I am about to find out.
Chapter 10 Joshua and Abigail were sitting across from their daughter Deborah and her new friend Ethan, in the big living room of their Colorado lodge. The log mansion was nestled in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, with land stretching all the way down to a winding river. The family loved the retreat. For Joshua particularly, it had been a haven from the world, a safe house from the forces of destruction, from men whose aim was to spread chaos and death. At Hawk's Nest, he could keep some of that at bay. Deborah, with some help from Ethan, had just described their experience on Flight 433 the day before. The boarding, the takeoff, the wild deviation of the big jet, the gut-wrenching experience of the big 797 being jolted into a drastic turn, and Deborah being grabbed by Ethan, keeping her from being tossed up into the ceiling. Then the flight's return to JFK and the interrogation of passengers. Her parents listened, unmoving. They took turns peppering her with questions. Finally, Joshua said, Two things are clear. First, your jet was responding to an actual security threat, not just a perceived one. Those pilots must have known they were at risk. Ethan was nodding fiercely. Colonel Jordan, copy on that. I think you're absolutely right, sir. Joshua turned to him. And the second thing, Ethan, is that your quick thinking probably saved my daughter from a fractured skull or worse. How can a father find words to thank a man who does that?
No need, sir. I'm proud to be of service to your family.
Your service and bravery on behalf of the nation, Colonel. Retired, Ethan. Now a civilian. You can call me Joshua.
That'll be hard.
Well, I can't pull rank and order you around anymore.
So you do remember me, sir, when I served under you at McGill Air Force Base?
Joshua nodded. He was silently recalling the details of a few nasty incidents involving Ethan. The drunken bar fights, the violation of flight rules. But Joshua was not going to dress down the man who had protected his daughter. Not a chance in a million. "I remember you, Ethan. And here you are. So my daughter says you worked with Raytheon." Just then the phone beeped. Abigail picked it up.
"Hello, Ted," she replied. "Great to hear from you."
She fell silent and turned toward Joshua, her expression growing somber. She winced and said,
"Josh, you'd better take this in the study."
Joshua quickly stepped around the corner, dodged into the library to his big desk with the multiple computers, and closed the door behind him. "Ted, what's up?" Ted was the chief weapons design engineer for Jordan Technologies. "Josh, bad news." "Tell me." "The jet crash, the one on the news." "Out of Chicago?" "Right, Flight 199. It went down because of a missile strike. Our sources in the Pentagon say that the White House is about to release an official statement."
"What?"
But before Joshua could formulate his next question, Ted jumped in. "There's something else. That flight was outfitted with an onboard RTS unit when it was struck." "Did the pilot launch our return to sender laser?" Silence. "Ted, talk to me. Did the pilot—"
"He tried to."
Joshua hesitated as if he'd been punched in the solar plexus. Ted kept talking.
"Reports are that the pilot went through the launch sequence for the RTS. They retrieved the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder from the wreckage. No word on that yet. But the tower said the pilot announced hitting the RTS button after the primary countermeasures, the flares, failed. But the RTS didn't stop the missile."
"How many?" "My God, Ted. How many?" "There were 88 on board." "Did anyone—"
"They're all gone, Josh. All dead."
When Joshua had collected himself, he said, "I want all your data transferred to me so I can review it here at Hawk's Nest. On the secure line. Everything you've got on that flight. Our install on that 797, all our protocols, the verification of the test runs, the sign-off by the FAA on that particular jet. Whatever you have on the crash. Everything, Ted. I want everything, and I want it stat." After he hung up, Joshua turned in his wooden swivel chair to look through the window, out to the tall trees and the impenetrable line of mountain peaks in the distance. His insides were numb, as if he'd received an anesthetic, but his mind raced wildly. More than that, there was the awful, crippling inner torque, the crush of responsibility bearing down on him like a 10-ton weight. The solitude of Hawk's Nest had been broken. The world was pressing in. Chapter 11. Harat Ithnain, Western Desert of Saudi Arabia. Like the surface of another planet, the wasteland stretched around him as far as the eye could see, a place with hellish temperatures and brutal terrain. Robert Hamilton, Ph.D., had dismounted his camel and was surveying the landscape of hardened black basaltic lava that had cooled into hostile, jagged rocks. His young assistant, Finley, was snapping digital photos. Back with the camels, Maher, their Saudi guide, was swishing his hand to keep the flies away. The two volcanologists had driven their Land Rover off the highway and into the desert for a few miles, where they met Maher, who was waiting with the camels. The Rover was no use from that point on. The terrain was impassable by motor vehicle. It was studded with half-ton basaltic rock bombs that had been tossed out of the volcano that had erupted just a few weeks earlier. Deep crevasses had recently ripped through the ground during the earthquake that accompanied the geological disruption. In the distance, a great volcanic cone rose from the Table Flat Desert during the recent eruption. Hamilton took off his wide-brimmed field hat and mopped the sweat that was beading on his bald scalp. He marveled at the scene in front of him. Finley stopped snapping pictures, studied his mentor, and said,
"Dr. Hamilton, do you need some water?"
Hamilton shook his head. Finley sheltered his eyes with a hand as he looked up in the general direction of the baking sun and said,
"I promised Mrs. Hamilton I'd make you take it easy."
"Not possible in this place. There's nothing easy here.
Just look at all of this, will you, Finley?"
He motioned toward the giant volcanic cone. But Finley was still concerned.
Perhaps you can sit down for a few minutes.
Hamilton shook his head and laughed. Finley, stop worrying. I'm not dying yet. I'll let you know when the time comes. Relax. Enjoy.
After swabbing his face with a rag, Hamilton took a few more steps toward the volcano. Then he started talking, almost to himself, as though he was delivering one of his lectures at the University of Hawaii, where he taught.
Back in 1256, not far from where we are now, during the Muslim holy days and the beginning of Jumada al-Akira, the people were gathering in Medina for prayers at the Mosque of the Prophet. That's when the earthquakes started. The ground cracked open. Underground, the basaltic magma was building. Then the eruption, fire in the sky, followed by 2 solid months of volcanic activity. Lava flows for 15 miles. The Muslims fled for their lives. They must have thought it was the end of the world.
Hamilton paused, reflecting. He swung around to face Finley.
But then, after that eruption, silence. For nearly 800 years, until now. Of course, there have been others like this one here in the Middle East. That eruption on the island of Astayir, off the coast of Yemen in 2007. That was impressive. Volcanic ash 1,000 feet in the air. And other ones in different parts of the world. The Icelandic eruption in 2010. But you see, Finley, folks don't realize how this region in particular, the whole of the Middle East from the Saudi Peninsula to Syria, is riddled with fault lines and volcanic fields.
Finley smiled and nodded. Maher says that he's got us a motel room in Al-Amair. If we leave now, we can make it before sundown.
We've got camping gear with us, for heaven's sake.
I'd hate to deal with your wife, Dr. Hamilton. If anything happened,
I finished the first round of chemo more than 2 weeks ago. I'm as strong as an ox.
Could you humor me, Dr. Hamilton? Please?
Hamilton shook his head. This was a major opportunity. Once in a lifetime, perhaps. In view of everything else in his life, he needed to nail this down with scientific precision. He wanted to start on his journal submission and hopefully get it published as a follow-up on some of his earlier published work. Time was not on his side, and he knew it. He spoke with resignation.
Fine, all right.
Let's head back. But we need to start tomorrow before sunrise and make the most of the day.
Hamilton was almost back to the camels when he stopped and looked back at Finley. He poked a finger in his direction.
Do you realize how big this is?
Finley smiled, but Hamilton looked him in the eyes, knowing that his assistant didn't really understand.
Finley, this is global, historic. What's going on here is scary stuff. I've got to get my data together and tell the climate people and global warming organizations. They've got to be told right away. Mind you, people are not going to want to hear this. The human race doesn't like bad news, especially the kind that upsets their apple cart.
Chapter 12. 88 dead. No survivors. That thought threatened to swallow Joshua whole. Somehow he managed to keep his MIT-educated engineer's brain trained on the task before him. Failure analysis. Why had the RTS system failed on Flight 199? Then there was the fighter pilot side of his brain, too. Never compromising, needing complete command and control, not satisfied with anything less than a fully successful mission. But the mission had failed. Terribly. So terribly that as Joshua studied the information on the computer screen, he had to tell himself not to think about the extended families of those 88 people, the grieving husbands, wives, children, grandchildren. How many? What if each passenger left only 2 surviving family members behind? That would be nearly 180 shattered lives, heartbroken and weeping. What if each had left 3 behind? And then again, what difference did a game of numbers make in the face of something so awful? As a military man, Joshua was used to the concept of casualties. He had seen them killed on missions and when things went bad while testing experimental aircraft in the desert. This was different. These were civilians.
When they bought their tickets, they hadn't signed up for the hazards of war. He caught himself. He had to steel himself to the task at hand. It was now a little before 4 in the morning, and Joshua had been in his study since receiving Ted's phone call. His team had sent him a dump of electronic data, and Joshua was scanning it for anomalies. Nothing jumped off the screen. He ran integrated consistency tests, his own software invention to cross-check each RTS unit, but he came up with nothing. He started to dig down into the granular details of each system of the commercial flight return-to-sender laser defense unit that he and his group had adapted from the original RTS design plan in order to arm civilian aircraft. At this point, Ted and Carolyn, who was the chief of weapon physics, hooked up with Joshua in a conference call. They double-checked everything on the final production protocol, item by item. The digital circuits, in case there had been an electrical failure. The digital logic design. Even the schematics for the diode array inside the laser. Then the onboard computer settings. The data-capturing directorate inside the laser, which commanded the laser beam to copy the signal inside the guidance system of the incoming missile. And the mirror-reverse command, which would instantaneously load the opposite trajectory into that enemy guidance system. All of the functions that were designed to operate while the approaching missile was traveling more than 1,000 miles an hour. Those systems were all checked, and they should have worked. All of them. After several hours on the telephone, Carolyn spoke up. Besides Joshua, she was the one most responsible for the overall operating principles behind the RTS. She was known for her bluntness. "We're chasing our tails." Joshua dismissed that. "No, we're missing something here. We have to stay on this until we find it." Carolyn wouldn't budge. "Josh, just hear me out. We're working with half the picture until we find out what the black box says and what the voice recorder picked up in the moments before the plane exploded. Till then, we're just working blind." Ted, the diplomat, intervened. "I think she's saying it's not logical to start on the premise that the RTS failed, that it was a production defect or a design flaw. Maybe it's something else." Joshua cut in. "Like what? Like maybe a flock of birds hit the engines?" Carolyn said, "Come on, Josh." "No, you come on, both of you. We can't look for the easy way out. 88 people dead. That's the body count. We need to find out why. You're saying we should assume pilot error in firing the RTS? Is that what you're saying?" "I don't think so." "We're not saying that," Ted countered. "Just that I was with you, remember? At the White Sands missile test range, when we ran through the commercial jet RTS tests, 10 out of 10. Perfect scores all the way around. Then the tests by the Defense Advanced Research Agency and the Missile and Space Intelligence Center. No glitches. The RTS took everything the Pentagon could throw at it." Carolyn broke in again. "You know what's going to happen, right? The other defense companies with their lasers, the traditional ones that act simply as blunt force weapons, blasting things out of the air, that sort of thing, are going to tell the Pentagon to dump us and start working with their lasers. They'll say the RTS comes with too much risk. And the politics behind this? You have to admit, Josh, we've been working in a political cyclone ever since the North Korean thing. Sure, RTS worked during that crisis last year, saved New York from the incoming North Korean nukes. But Congress and the presses, they treated us like Nazis, for crying out loud." "We're off track," Joshua said. But Ted needed to counter something else. "Listen, Carolyn, your point about the blunt force kind of lasers, we all know why they don't work well. Too heavy, too bulky. They have to intercept at too close a range. And if they miss the target, they blow up some innocent plane. The solid-state ones are still lacking, and the chemically energized lasers are like elephants. But the RTS is like a cheetah, except it's got the IQ of Einstein. Let's keep reminding ourselves what your RTS laser defense, Joshua, has achieved. It doesn't blast missiles out of the sky, which is still too hard to do accurately. Instead, it captures data from a guidance system and recalibrates it with the speed of light. That's revolutionary. Anyway, let's keep an open mind. Maybe, like Carolyn says, our assumptions are all wrong. Maybe it wasn't installed properly. Our staff supervised the installations on the commercial jets. Then maybe another factor." "Look, people," Joshua said with fatigue in his voice. We have to face the possibility that we screwed up, and now there's a death toll.
I'm not ready to take the rap for that, Carolyn bulleted back. Not until we know every fact, and we're far from that right now.
And one more thing, Joshua asked.
What?
Like Ted says, our RTS is the best thing we've got to protect Americans from offensive missiles. The best, period. Start doubting that, and more Americans are going to die.
There was a knock on the door of Joshua's study. Joshua put Ted and Carolyn on hold. Abigail was there in the doorway in her pajamas.
Just wanted to see how you're doing.
Not good. You should be asleep.
Are you kidding?
Ted told me a few things when he called, so I have a pretty good idea about what's going on and what's in your head right now.
Joshua snapped back, sharper than he should have. So it's Abby the mind reader?
On this I am. You're shouldering the responsibility for the deaths of all those people on the Chicago flight. It was a horrible thing, but you can't put this on yourself.
And why not?
Because it's too early in the investigation to start taking blame.
Why is everyone trying to get me to shirk this thing?
No one's doing that.
Sure you are. And Ted and Carolyn, too. I'm the only one willing to admit failure.
Or maybe,
Abigail started to say.
What?
Abigail's eyes flashed.
Maybe it's your maddening perfectionism, Josh. Your obsession. Whether it's missile defense or your children or...
This isn't about me.
I think it is. You're too quick to beat yourself up. You're a glutton for punishment over this RTS thing.
Joshua shook his head. Abigail bowed hers.
Sorry, that was a rotten thing to say.
After a few moments of silence, Joshua said, I've got to get back to my conference call. I'm flying out early tomorrow back to the office. The jet's ready.
Cal's going to be disappointed.
He's arriving tomorrow afternoon. He'll understand.
He said he had something to tell you.
Whatever it is, it'll have to wait. Then Joshua softened. Look, tell him we'll definitely talk, okay? Then Joshua thought of something. Did Ethan March stay overnight?
Yes, I put him in the guest wing, that all right?
Fine.
Speaking of New York, I didn't tell you...
What?
Got a letter from Pastor Campbell. It was a thank you for the gift I sent from both of us, the one for the Eternity Church Inner City Project. He said he was looking forward to another round of golf with you, you know, when you're back in the city.
Joshua didn't answer. Golf seemed absurdly irrelevant at the moment.
Okay, I'll leave you alone.
As she was about to leave, she added,
I'm just thankful we have our daughter, considering what could have happened.
Joshua nodded. He was embarrassed that his RTS analysis had distracted him from the fact that Deborah was safe and sound, thanks to Ethan. But when Joshua looked back to where Abigail had been standing, she was gone, and the door was closed. Chapter 13 In the city of Taraz, at the border of northern Kyrgyzstan and southern Kazakhstan. It was a fine day for planning death and mass destruction, particularly for the silver-haired Ivan Radinovad, Russia's debonair chief of special operations. For several years, he had headed up a secret project, something called Nevidimij Medvich, Invisible Bear. Now it was on the verge of final, devastating implementation. Radinovad leaned back in his chair and looked around the room. He was pleased with his new strategic headquarters. He had taken over the old stone-walled museum situated on the ancient Silk Road. The museum was part of the mausoleum of Manas, who was a folk hero and an ancient mythical figure in Central Asia. Considering the discussion he was about to have, there was a certain poetic symbolism in his selection of this place. According to legend, Manas sported a variety of magical weapons, and when he died, his widow put a false inscription on his grave to trick his enemies so they wouldn't desecrate his resting place. So, there it was. Advanced weaponry and deception. Nothing could epitomize Russia's plan better than that. And Kyrgyzstan was a good choice to house Russia's secret meetings for dominance, which involved its partnership with Iran and North Korea. It was remote and would avoid the global scrutiny of Moscow or its other major cities.
Over the years, Russia had gathered back its union of former Soviet republics. Russia's concerns about a watching world were justified. It had provided missile technology to North Korea. And back in 2010, Russia had successfully defied the world and provided enriched uranium to Iran for its nuclear program, and had even helped build its reactors. But Iran wasn't the focus of the meeting that day with Radinovat. Today it was North Korea's turn. The Russian looked across the table at the emotionless face of Po Kung-gang, North Korea's head of offensive nuclear ambitions. Po turned to his left and right. Both of his North Korean assistants gave him a quick head bow of agreement. Po was a man of considerable power in his country. He had worked personally under Jang Song-taek, the man selected to ensure the transition of succession from Kim Jong-il to Kim's son, Kim Jong-un, shortly before the elder Kim's death. But Jang had been more than just a pencil-pushing bureaucrat. He ran the National Defense Commission. He was cold, unstoppable, and brutal. And for Po Kung-gang, he had been Jang's most promising disciple.
"So then, it is done," Po announced.
"And you will implement this through intermediaries?" The Russian nodded. "Yes, we have good connections, well-trained cell groups, and the scientific muscle to put this together."
"Good. North Korea will have its revenge. But like your Russia, we need the cloak of anonymity. The international community will have suspicions about who's behind this attack, but they must never have proof. Now these cell groups, they must not be sidetracked by their own personal zeal."
"That won't be a problem. They share a common purpose with us. They've always dreamed of a nuclear strike, and now it's going to happen. A great opportunity. They won't disappoint."
"And the ships?" Po asked.
"We have the final route picked out. It is still easy to transfer ownership and thus switch shipping names and flags at each port without raising suspicions. We will move your ship with the nuclear material and the detonator to the first port. Meanwhile, the weapon hardware, which has been quality controlled by our scientists, will be on another ship. They will eventually meet up in Durban, and the components will continue on to the shores of the target. Then, inland, the two bombs will be assembled and driven to their destinations." Po nodded vigorously.
"And that," Po said, his granite face breaking into a rare expression of joy, "is when the great flower will bloom."
The North Korean cupped his hands and slowly, delicately, expanded his fingers, like a street mime, in the graceful arching shape of a blooming flower. But that wasn't it. Po was simulating the image of a nuclear mushroom cloud rising in the sky. Now they were all smiling.
Chapter 14. Hawk's Nest.
"I'm not some giggling schoolgirl. I'm a grown woman. Somehow you seem to forget that."
Abigail was studying her daughter's posture, resistant, arms folded over her chest. Abigail tried the reasonable approach, sort of.
"Of course you're a grown woman, but I'm your mother. My job doesn't end just because you're in the top three of your class at West Point. In terms of your life, maybe Dad and I aren't president and vice president anymore, but we still serve on your cabinet."
"Cute analogy," Deborah sighed. "But I need the freedom to exercise my own judgment when it comes to relationships, okay?"
Deborah didn't wait for an answer. She rose from her porch chair. She pretended to study the mountains and the morning sun now rising over the peaks, yet her posture gave her away. She thrust her hands in her jeans, agitated, and rocked back and forth on her toes. Abigail had a momentary thought as she looked at the empty rustic chair that her daughter had just vacated. It had been fashioned out of intertwined tree limbs. Abigail had lovingly picked it out at a crafter's shop in the mountains when they first moved in. How little my children understand the love that went into picking out that furniture. Something masculine and rugged that Josh would like. Something comfortable for the family to sit in, to dream in, to make memories in. Abigail glanced over at her daughter and her resistant posture. Yes, you are a woman, my darling daughter, and I do love you so. But you still have so much to learn.
Abigail had been surprised by her daughter over the last 24 hours. Deborah had been glued to Ethan's side until this morning when he announced he was taking a jog. Deborah wanted to join him, but Abigail talked her into joining her on the porch. Deborah seemed ready to fall for this man, who was still a near stranger, even if he had been her gallant rescuer. Abigail realized she still had things to learn about her own daughter.
"Deb, sit down. That sounds like an order. Come on, stop the game playing. Just sit with me for a few minutes."
Deborah cocked her head with a look of futility and dropped into the chair.
"Darling," Abigail began again, "all I did was to remind you to guard your heart. That's all."
"No, it's much more than that.
I can decipher your mom talk. Translation, you're telling me don't get involved with Ethan March. Don't deny it. I know you too well, and that's exactly what you're implying. You've sized him up and already have a verdict."
"Not at all. Just take things slowly. You know very little about him."
"Like what?"
"Mom, this isn't a marriage proposal we're talking about. I'm just trying to get to know him."
"As a Christian, you can't be unequally partnered with a non-believer. The Bible's clear on that. I didn't come to the Lord until years after I married your father. He's a great man and a good husband, but you know how I've struggled with the fact that he hasn't made the same commitment to Christ I have. My advice is to handle first things first, like finding out where Ethan is spiritually."
"Well, if you cut me some slack and leave us alone, maybe I could do my own personal intel, get some private time with him, and find out."
"And there's an age difference. He's 7 years older."
Deborah gave an exasperated grunt and threw her head back. Then Abigail spotted Ethan in the distance, running toward them, returning from his jog. She had to talk quickly.
"Just take your time, that's all. I respect you, trust you, love you.
Which means I'll always give you straight talk, especially about things that are really important."
As Ethan jogged up to them, he slowed to a walk, hands on his hips as he panted. Deborah tried not to stare, but she couldn't help it. Ethan was in a pair of sweatpants and a tank top with the words "Big Dog" in large letters on the front. His arms and torso were well-muscled, almost sculpted. He hadn't shaved yet. He was handsome, and she had already memorized his slightly skewed nose, but now realized that he had a scar on his left cheekbone. While Deborah stared at Ethan, her mother was staring at her. Ethan flashed a big smile. "Good morning, ladies."
"Good morning, Ethan," Abigail started. "Have a good sleep?"
"Perfect, thanks." He turned and took in the mountains in the distance. "Man, this place is magnificent." Before her mother could respond, Deborah jumped in.
"Ethan, how about you and I go horseback riding? We could pack a lunch. It'll be a blast. I bet you haven't been given the official Hawk's Nest tour. Come on, I'll show you around."
Deborah reached out and took his arm. As they walked away, she threw her mother a look as they rounded the side of the house. Abigail was left on the porch alone. She knew that her children were, well, not children anymore. Was she having problems letting go? Or did she have fears about her own role in life right now? She had been an accomplished and successful lawyer on Capitol Hill, but being a mother was different. It defined her, down to her soul. She sat down and put her feet up on the rough-hewn log coffee table, leaning back, closing her eyes, and she did what she did whenever she felt confused. She prayed. There was never anything high church about it, just plain talk to her Heavenly Father. She hadn't known her own father very well. She was 10 when he died. But God was always there, even if she sometimes ached for the Lord to be there in the flesh. As she prayed, she lost track of time. It must have been a half an hour later when she heard car tires crunching over gravel. She opened her eyes. Her son, Cal, was climbing out of his Jeep with his suitcase in his hand. She strolled down the porch steps, gave him a long hug, and peppered him with kisses.
"How'd your art show go? I am so sorry Dad and I couldn't make it, but you know how proud we are.
Your father was fit to be tied when he learned our jet had developed a minor gauge problem. Not a big deal, apparently, but you know your father.
Anyway, by then we couldn't catch a commercial flight."
"Don't worry about it, Mom. The show was, oh, interesting, I guess. Where's Dad?"
had to fly to New York at the break of dawn. Finally got the gauge problem fixed, and some security upgrades. Anyway, I know he wanted to see you, but he's got a real crisis on his hands.
Carl's voice was tinged with cynicism.
Dad handling some crisis?
Yeah, that'd be something new.
Abigail replied with a sly smile.
Hey, mister, he's bailed you out of a crisis or two.
Cal gave her a funny look. His eyes narrowed.
Yeah, I know.
You have no idea how much I still think about that. She nodded and waited for more. When it didn't come, she asked,
Can I fix you breakfast?
I'd love it. I've been driving straight for 2 days. I couldn't wait to get here.
As they walked inside, Cal seemed buried in his thoughts.
What's on your mind? Abigail asked.
A question.
What?
Oh, it can wait. At least until I get some food in me.
Come on, don't keep your mother waiting. If I feed your belly, you have to satisfy my curiosity.
Cal stopped and set his suitcase down.
The subject's kind of a downer. Try me.
I keep thinking about it. About almost getting killed.
Abigail didn't speak. She just waited, with a look that said she loved him no matter what.
And it's about him, said Cal. I've been thinking about him lately. Don't know why. We haven't mentioned his name for a while. I guess we've been trying to forget it.
Which name? She asked, even though she already knew.
His face twisted a little and his mouth was pulled tight.
Atta Zimler.
The name belonged to the psychopath who, for one short, terrifying moment, had Cal in his grip. It was a name that the family had tried to forget as things returned to normal. As she looked at her son, she saw the man in him, even though, considering what he had endured in that harrowing episode, her impulse was always to coddle him a bit, try to protect him. Abigail had been a tough, no-nonsense trial lawyer, but when it came to Cal, the risk was always that she would be too soft. She never worried about being too hard on him. She didn't have to. Josh, with all his good intentions, always played that part well. Cal kept talking.
I was just wondering, you know, whether Zimler is dead or not. I know the FBI told us he might have been killed, but I need to know.
His jaw flexed and his face tightened, but Abigail could see that this was not fear. It was a new kind of resolve that used to belong only to his father. He finished the thought. Whether he's still out there somewhere. I need to know that.
Chapter 15. Desert Palm Bank, in the Dubai, World Trade Center, United Arab Emirates. Mr. Jorgensen, welcome. The banker reached out to shake hands with the customer who was carrying a briefcase. The customer looked the part of a Swede. The man's hair had been dyed blonde. He had blue contacts in his eyes and had endured the sacrifice of staying shaded from the sun to keep his skin from tanning. While the customer had been spending the last few days on a rented yacht in the Dubai Marina, he had to wear long sleeves and a ball cap. What a drag. The banker continued. I'm sure you remember the procedures for our safety deposit boxes. The customer smiled. Yes, I certainly do. The banker would have no way of knowing how well the man with the briefcase understood the security procedures. In fact, this customer had visited the commercial section of the tower before, during its construction. He had cased out the bank, and particularly the safety precautions being installed, even as it was being built. He was a man who could keep tabs on potential high-dollar hits like this one, targets that could help fund the lavish globe-trotting lifestyle to which he'd become accustomed. His mobility was necessary for other reasons, too, like the fact that Interpol, Scotland Yard, France's Direction Centrale de la Police Judiciaire, and the FBI were all looking for him. Come this way, the banker said. He led the customer into a frosted glass cubicle with a soft chair and a small table. The cubicle led to a locked steel door, which, when opened, led down a dead-end hallway filled with safety deposit boxes and a video touchscreen. I'll leave you to your business. If you need anything, Mr. Jorgensen, just let me know. With that, the banker left the cubicle and closed the door behind him. The customer set down his briefcase and opened it. He took out the credit card of Rolf Jorgensen. He walked over to the big metal door and swiped the card in the locking device. A green light on the door lit up. He heard the heavy click as it unlocked, pushed it open with a briefcase in his hand, and looked to his right at the touch screen. He tapped in the security code that Mr. Jorgensen had given him under duress. That was before things got even uglier for the Swedish broker who dealt in precious gems. Now came the only part that presented a mild obstacle. The customer looked at a box on the screen that read in a dozen different languages, "Place palm here for biometric identification." He reached into his briefcase and pulled out a spray can and a small plastic case. He snapped the case open and pulled out a tissue-thin polymer cutout of a right-hand palm print. It had been taken from Mr. Jorgensen in a manner that ensured a painstakingly perfect duplication. The customer carefully laid the tissue-thin imprint across his own hand. Then, with his left hand, he used the latex spray to mist a fixative over the polymer imprint of Jorgensen's palm, securing it temporarily to his own. He placed his palm onto the screen and tapped the button. For a few seconds, nothing. Then the screen lit up. "Identification confirmed. Hello, Mr. Jorgensen. You may now proceed to access your lockbox with your key." He wanted to say something to the surveillance cameras in the corners of the ceiling, but didn't. Something viciously cynical like, "So sorry Mr. Jorgensen wasn't able to be here. He would have sent his regrets, but that was impossible. They have probably found him by now with his neck broken and his right hand cut off. Who could have done such a thing?" Instead, he smiled at the cameras and walked past the security boxes until he came to Jorgensen's. He slipped the key in and opened the small door. A bundle of papers and a black velvet bag were inside. He pulled out the bag and strolled back to the cubicle. The light was better there. He tucked a jeweler's glass over his eye and spread the contents of the bag on the table. 2 dozen large, brilliant diamonds glinted with an inner fire. Yes, this would do. He would get $250,000, maybe $250,000 for them if he was lucky. Usually that was chump change, but now money was tight. He had to be more discreet than usual. His last client, Caesar Demas, the international business celebrity, a friend to the Vice President of the United States and the chum of the Secretary General of the UN, had not paid him for his last job. At least not the second half of the contracted job. That came as no surprise, of course, because the American job didn't work out the way that he and Demas had planned. But for Atta Zimler, the customer in the bank's security cubicle who was impersonating a Swedish diamond broker, there was no such thing as failure. It was just a matter of delay. He had every intention of finishing what he'd started the year before in a New York City train station, and when he was through, and he offered Demas what he still hoped to obtain, then he would get his money from Caesar Demas, or else. After he had placed the bag of diamonds in his briefcase, secured the lockbox, and unlocked the frosted glass cubicle, he strolled back, his Italian-made shoes clicking on the marble floor of the bank lobby. Always looking for an opportunity, he spotted some mints on the counter outside the window of a pretty bank teller. He walked over. He put his hand into the dish and pulled out a small candy. "I was looking for something sweet," Zimler said to her with a smile as he lingered at the window. Chapter 16. In the Manhattan office of Jordan Technologies, Joshua and his research and development team had worked around the clock for 2 days on their design data for the commercial version of the RTS laser anti-missile system. They had found nothing to explain the failure of RTS to stop the terrorist missile that downed the ill-fated 797. His engineers had theories, but no real answers. Joshua was in his office with Ted. As Joshua looked out the window to the New York skyline, he thought back to something his weapons physicist, Carolyn, had said. So Joshua put the question to Ted. "How soon can we get the data from the black box and the voice recorder?" Ted said, "The FAA isn't the problem. The real issue is getting the okay from Homeland Security to share the data with us. That'll be a high hurdle." "I don't understand," Joshua complained. "We designed the system. We're part of the team." "Yes and no.
Don't forget that the feds placed all kinds of restrictions on a pilot's ability to hit the RTS button, like getting permission from the tower first. It's all part of their concern about the consequences if a missile is turned around in a highly populated area. The RTS could result in huge casualties on the ground, but we explained we were working on refinements to minimize collateral damage. Until then, our current RTS is the best thing going. They can't blackball us. Ted pulled out his handheld wireless all phone, clicked on the headline news, and said, "Maybe this will explain." Joshua looked at the screen. His stomach turned. The headline read, "Return to Sender Failure Cited for Chicago Air Disaster." "You'll notice," Ted said, "that the media guys don't report that terrorist crazies shot a missile at the plane, and that's why it fell from the sky." Ted took his all phone back and started searching for something else. "Like we've said all along," Ted noted, "the biggest obstacle is always the politics." He swooped his finger over the screen. After a moment, he said, "Found it." "Yeah, I wanted to see what Amerinews had to say. They're the only ones giving you a break." Joshua kept his mouth shut. If anyone on his tech team could be trusted to be discreet, it was Ted. Even so, Joshua had never shared with Ted his connection to Amerinews. Joshua had been intimately involved with this controversial new entrant into the electronic media, the first to finally bust open the media monopoly that the White House had willingly allowed to develop and exploited for political purposes. The Roundtable was a secret group of like-minded business, political, and financial leaders with Joshua at its head. Together, they had launched Amerinews to counter the encroaching information censorship that had taken place throughout the country. Joshua had been so absorbed in receiving the RTS documents that he missed the headlines on his own news service. "Okay," Ted said. "Amerinews reports, and this is just 2 hours ago, that they are questioning whether the feds are being forthright in the investigation of the Chicago air disaster. Any details?" "No, not yet. Just speculation. Wish they'd give us some specific information." Joshua knew why they couldn't. Phil Rankowitz, the Roundtable's media leader for Amerinews, must not have been able to dig up anything either, even with the help of his high-octane team of investigative reporters. "Okay, Ted," Joshua had to admit. "I dreaded finding some design flaw in our commercial RTS. Frankly, I can't see it yet. But I don't like not knowing, either. Thanks for assembling the team and putting together all the schematics so quickly. Good effort. I'm flying back to Hawk's Nest, as soon as Billy fuels up the jet." After Ted left, Joshua called Phil Rankowitz and talked to him about the upcoming meeting of the Roundtable at his Colorado estate. "Phil, I just read your headline blurb. About the Chicago jet shootdown?" "Right. What do you know that I don't? And what aren't you able to say yet on Amerinews?" "Only one thing. There's a blogger who keeps popping up with stuff that drives the media moguls and the White House crazy. He runs something called Leakopedia. Remember the old days of WikiLeaks? The blog that used to post high-level leaks and cause all kinds of chaos? Well, this is the next generation, but with a twist. This guy is different. He doesn't just get classified documents and dump them into the public sphere. He does the old-fashioned, high-definition kind of investigative reporting where there's honest-to-gosh high-level corruption, then posts his stories before he gets shut down. Who is he?" "A former investigative reporter named Belltether. Used to work at a newspaper before print journalism went the way of the dodo bird." "What's his angle?" "Not sure, but one of our Amerinews stringers says he heard from a friend of a friend who knows Belltether that he's working on a scoop on the Flight 199 attack." "I think you've got something up your sleeve, Phil."
"I do. If this story checks out, we may want to buy it as an Amerinews exclusive."
"Bellwether doesn't sound like he's rolling in dollars. If he's a former print reporter, he's probably living off a diet of grubworms by now. I'm sure we could work a deal with him. Offer him money to hire him for an exclusive. Give him our platform."
"Sounds like a plan.
I've got some things of my own I need to bring up at the Roundtable. See you in a couple of days at Hawk's Nest." After the call, Joshua hit speed dial on his all phone for an encrypted number. It rang 3 times, and a man picked up. "Patriot," was all he said. Joshua could tell it was Pack McHenry,
the head of the private unit of former spies and ex-intelligence spooks that the roundtable occasionally worked with. "Pack, we need to talk. I've got a crisis. By my book, you've got more than one. Which crisis are you calling about?" Joshua pondered that and said, "The missile attack on Flight 199. We're still working on that, nothing new. But I expect something to break any day." "What other crisis are you talking about?" "National security. The nuke threat. The things I'd mentioned to you in the roundtable some time ago but could never nail down. It looks like we'll have something for you in 48 hours. "Perfect. We're meeting in 2 days. I'll connect with you and your group via encrypted flashmail video. But be forewarned. Oh, it won't be pretty." Chapter 17. At Hawk's Nest, before the roundtable met, Joshua took his son Cal aside. "I know you wanted to talk. Nothing urgent. But, yeah, I'd like to talk, Dad. How about after the roundtable conference?" Cal was nonchalant. "No problem." Joshua nodded. He was tempted to pursue it. He loved Cal. The terror episode of the year before had made him appreciate his son even more, even though, strangely, it hadn't seemed to have brought them any closer together. He clapped Cal on the shoulder before striding into the conference room in the working wing of his lodge. Every chair around the huge table was filled. The wall of windows offered a breathtaking view of the mountains, but no one was taking in the view. They were staring at something else. All eyes were on the wall-sized InstantSat video screen at the end of the room. The super-secure flashmail satellite feed was about to start. The roundtable included some of America's most successful entrepreneurs, media executives, former politicians, judges, and retired military leaders. Most were multimillionaires. Some were worth more. All were powerful influences in their fields. Abigail was at the table. Retired Judge Fortis Fort Rice had insisted that she head up the group's legal unit, although with Joshua acting as the chair, she kept a low profile. One new member was in attendance, a recently retired special agent from the FBI, a paunchy fellow named John Gallagher who looked slightly out of place. He wore a crumpled suit and a golf shirt that didn't match his jacket. While at the bureau, he had a reputation for two things: an eccentric approach that put him at odds with FBI protocol, and an effective knack for cracking terrorist cells. Joshua stood up and addressed the group. "In a minute, you will hear the voice of one of our most trusted allies. I am one of the few people here who knows his identity." Joshua gave John Gallagher a quick glance. The former special agent was the only person in the room besides Abigail who knew who Pack McHenry was. Gallagher had dealt with McHenry's Patriot Group, a private cadre of security and intelligence gurus, during the nerve-rattling incident at New York's Grand Central Station. That was where Gallagher had first come into contact with Joshua, Cal, and the rest of the Jordan family. At that time, Gallagher, as the chief of the Bureau's New York terrorism unit, had long been tracking Atta Zimler, still number two on the FBI's most wanted list. The episode at the train station was as close as he'd ever come to Zimler, but not close enough. Joshua continued, "Our contact's voice will be altered and his image scrambled, but his information will be unimpeachable. You will know him only as the Patriot. He leads a group of volunteers, all of whom formerly worked in the national security system or law enforcement. His group decided, as we have, that the fate of our nation hangs perilously in the balance. Our leaders are either incapable or, worse, unwilling to take the steps necessary to save us. So the Patriots decided to take responsible action, as we have. You are about to hear about the grave threat that our country is facing." The video screen lit up. In the live feed, a man was sitting at a desk, his face digitally blurred. "Good day," said the image. "As I proceed, if anyone has questions, don't hesitate to interrupt me. We have credible information that a nuclear strike inside the United States is imminent. I'm talking within American shores. I know Joshua has mentioned this to you before, but only in general terms. Today I can be more specific. Our agents have traced this threat to the Russian Federation. Reliable sources indicate that meetings orchestrated by Moscow have been held at a special location in Kyrgyzstan.
We believe the two other nation-states involved are North Korea and Iran. It appears that Kyrgyzstan is the strategic planning site for these attacks. Former Senator Alvin Leander, a short, feisty man with a bald head, shot out the first question. Why Kyrgyzstan, for crying out loud? The man on the screen was precise as he explained. We have to start with Russia's overthrow of Kyrgyzstan in April of 2010. In subsequent years, America retreated from its military air base there. The U.S. gave up our military base near Bishkek, which we had been using for our war in Afghanistan before we withdrew militarily from that country. As a result, it left Russia in unchallenged control of Kyrgyzstan. Russia managed to take control over the entire Collective Security Treaty Organization, the regional security coalition of all the former Soviet republics. With Kyrgyzstan firmly in Moscow's lap, and a slow, steady process of putting all of its neighboring republics back under the Russian thumb, we see something amazing and very dangerous. The former Soviet Empire has been entirely reconstructed, without any international condemnation or sanctions from the UN, and this time without the need for a bloody revolution. Of course, the current administration in Washington is aware of this, but has opted to treat the rise of Russian power diplomatically. They don't see the risks. There is one more thing, the man on the screen added. There was a pause. Leander said, "We're waiting." That Kyrgyzstan site is being monitored. A North Korean nuclear expert attended a meeting there, but we have intelligence that Iran is also involved. So you think Iran is in on this nuclear plot? Exactly. Against the U.S.? Iran may have a role, but their main interest is Israel. As we know, Iranian leaders have long harbored the desire to obliterate Israel. The other player, North Korea, has long despised our nation and wants to retaliate against the United States for destroying one of their Navy vessels with the successful use of Mr. Jordan's RTS system. So, that's the playbook and the players. Retired General Rocky Bridger, a stocky man with short salt-and-pepper hair, jumped in. He took off his reading glasses and tapped them on the table. "What's the operational plan for the attack?" "We don't have anything definitive yet, but some data indicate that portable nuclear devices are involved." Bridger followed up. "Have you shared this with our government?" "Of course. Central Intelligence Agency, Defense Intelligence Agency, and the FBI. I've sent this to all of my contacts." "And?" Bridger wondered out loud. "At first, some interest. But as time goes on, we have no assurances that our leads will be followed up on, and some evidence that they never will." "How would you know if they had or hadn't? You don't have the same resources as the government." "I can't reveal sources, General, but we have friends in critical positions along the chain of command. They report that the data we shared with key federal agencies was, well, treated like a patient declared DOA in an emergency room." Now Gallagher piped up. "Are you saying there's a cancer in the government?" "Mr. Gallagher, I am not at liberty to speculate. That's one thing we don't do. I'm tempted, but just can't go any further. The new consolidation of national security agencies, while that has had some advantages, has one big disadvantage. There are now fewer people at the top who have the power to decide when to pursue and when not to pursue a threat." Gallagher wouldn't let up. "Well, let's assume that there's something rotten. How high?" "Attorney General? Higher than that." Now Joshua turned to the former FBI special agent and had to draw the line. "John, our contact said he won't speculate. We have to leave it at that." Gallagher shrugged with obvious displeasure. "I have a question," Joshua said. "You said portable nuclear devices. How do you know?" "The device that triggers a nuclear bomb is called a neutron initiator. Now Russia's always known how to make them. They were in the nuke race with us for years. Supposedly, since the new START treaty with the U.S. under President Obama, they were going to stop further testing and development of offensive nuclear weapons, but we know differently.
and at the same time, we were hampered in developing anti-missile defenses. Even your own RTS is arguably forbidden under the START Treaty, at least according to the Russians. But Russia started partnering with North Korea and Iran to get them to do Russia's bidding